from the beginning.
what beginning?
This is Sabrina George for New Comedy Radio interviewing Barry Cryer.
Who's not been very helpful.
We've actually done this section before, but what I'd like to know, Barry, for those who don't know, who aren't avid present, because we're on everything on Radio 4 at the moment, is a poet, stand-up, writer,
singer,
general bon vivant.
That's
fair. Man about town, and So let's just guide our way through this. When you were at university,
yes.
You were doing engineering at Leeds.
No.
What were you doing at Leeds?
English. And BA English failed of Leeds University. I think I said this to you before, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Yes.
So we're doing this again. You left. Let's go back right to the beginning. What was your first step into comedy?
Nothing was deliberate. It was all an accident. If you're talking about first step, I mean, we all did shows at university. We all wrote sketches and songs and performed, but nobody that I remember had any show business aspirations or thought they were going to go into that. Even at the time, my old friend Tony Harrison, I think I mentioned him before, who's reached great eminence as playwright and, you know,
opera
all over the world,
and
opera,
yeah.
And oh, and everything, and poet. And Tony was in the shows with us, and I've just got back in touch with him after quite a while, which is wonderful, because he did a Radio 4 interview with Mark Lawson on Front Row and mentioned me, so I'm perking up. I thought, that's great. And I must listen, it's Tone. And then Mark Lawson said, you knew Barry at university. Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. And he said, tell me again about that poem he wrote. And I'm listening, thinking, what is this? And Tony Harrison said, oh, yeah, he said, I think he was editing the Union magazine or something. And he said, Barry wrote a little poem. And then he recited it, and I'd forgotten it. I was so touched. And it was just a little joke poem. It was Lot became naturally rather peeved when his sex life came to a halt. Well, wouldn't you, if you had to make do with occasional pinches of salt? And I couldn't believe it. Dear old Tony, it must have been, you know, only 50 years or something. It was lovely. It's lovely, but I'm digressing as usual. No, I don't think any of my contemporaries. Wally Soyinka, I was at university with, who went on to win a Nobel Prize and everything, was imprisoned.
As a writer.
In the old Civil War, you know, in the old Nigeria and everything. And I'm quite proud and pleased that I knew Wally, and we've spoken on the phone once or twice, and he's been in England, but we haven't got it together. I didn't say this to you before. A guy came up to Leeds to see somebody in a student show, not me, and saw me telling jokes and offered me work, and my first year results were in, which weren't good. And I thought, I've let everybody down. I was on the floor, you know, blue eyes, got to university and blew it. And this guy's offering me work. So, you know, in one hand I've got my first year results, and the other hand I've got an offer of work. I thought, no contest.
Off to work.
I'd go with the flow. Off I went.
Mm.
And my mother was wonderful, because my dad was dead. My dad died when I was 5. My brother was away in the Merchant Navy. So it was, you know, classic sort of Freudian me and my mum at home. I'm honorary gay. Kenny Everett said, you're honorary gay, bar, he said, friend of the family. And my mother was wonderful, and I went off on the road in shows called Fanny Get Your Fun, and We've Nothing On Tonight. We've got the pictures, strippers. I was ecstatic.
Just to go into what was having an agent and what was touring like then?
Well, I didn't have an agent, really. This guy, he wasn't formerly my agent. I can't even remember his his name is so long ago. He just employed me as per show by show. So I didn't have an agent or any formal basis in those days in the business.
So he told you what to do?
Well, he just employed me and said, do what I saw you doing in the student show. But I quickly realised that I was in a show with strippers and they hadn't come to see you. You were the obligatory comic. And I don't mean, I wasn't very blue or very heavy in my material, but I loosened up very quickly. I think I was a good learner. And I learned a sort of style to suit the show. But it was a false start, because after about 6 weeks from now, I was back in Leeds. Tail between my legs, at false start. You know.
And were you writing all your own material, or were these all standard?
Stealing.
You were stealing other people?
I was stealing from star comedians I'd heard on the radio, or the wireless as it was then known. And that's all you knew. I was quite imaginative. I could put the jokes together and link them up with stuff. But you weren't remotely original, you know. You were imitating your idols. You hadn't a style of your own or anything. You just... names I'm sure people to this day will sort of know, like Max Wall, who was an absolute idol of mine on the radio, and then I got to know and work with later on. Marvellous thing in my life was I met a lot of my idols. You know, people that I only knew as great names, and then the years went by and I finished up working with them and everything, which is great.
So within that 6 weeks, were you actually ever working with other comics, or were you only working with...
Oh, there was usually a senior comedian. I remember, good, I hadn't thought about him for years. I wonder if he's still alive. There was an Irish comedian called Charlie Ellis. Not a very Irish-type name, is it, Charlie Ellis? And he must have looked askance. Who's this young one they've found? But he was marvellous to me. He was like a mentor, because I was no threat. I was a young stand-up doing 12 minutes early in the show. And
that's all you were doing, 12 minutes?
About 12. Well,
and that was an evening's work?
That happened for quite a long time. Oh, yeah.
You
I was a bottom-of-the-bill comic, and you did 12 minutes. And then as the years went on, a few years, not long, I was in twice nightly variety. You did two shows a night, so you did your 12 minutes
twice. So what,
twice.
What happened? Did an MC come on stage, warm up the audience, and then threw you in?
There was no MC. It was just
so you
a bill.
You went on...
No, the show just started, and maybe some dancers came on, or something happened, and then... I would come on, bottom of the bill, very early. People maybe still coming in from the bar. You were almost like the warm-up yourself. You just...
And was it like mainly normal theatres?
Yeah, small theatres, what they used to call the number threes.
Right.
The Regent Rotherham and the Royal Bilston and
so
the Royalty Chester.
So what size of audience were you doing?
What
size of audience were you doing? Because now
smallish
theatres.
There were smallish theatres. I don't know numerically. Probably in the theatre was hardly ever completely full. There might be on a good night 300 or 400 people in. You know.
Yeah, because now that would be a big audience for a newish comic.
Oh yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Oh yes,
so you
indeed.
Straight into working with.
I mean, to this day, if I, you know, when I'm on tour, I play art centres and everything, and you got 300, and you are delighted because the place is full.
Mm,
so I mean, it's all gone full circle.
So then you had six weeks of a little bit of glory, and then you went
false
home
start,
to Leeds.
False start,
yeah.
As I said. Went home, and my mother was wonderful. No recriminations or anything. It was just sort of almost unsaid, but, oh, he's back. Maybe he'll calm down and get a proper job, you know. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I went back to the old Empire Theatre in Leeds, where I'd been prancing about as a student, showing off. And a marvellous man called Johnny Gunn, stage manager, bulky, big Scots guy, lovely man, stage manager. And I went to see him. I said, John, he said, I thought you were... You're off and away. I said, well, I'm back, John. And he got me a job as a stagehand. And in the mornings, I emptied and filled three bars, stalled, circle and gallery. No lift. And I can tell you, empties are very heavy.
Yes.
Empties are heavy. And I did that in the morning and midday. I did all the stocking up the bars and working with other people, but I was doing all the carrying. Then I went home and fell over and had a bit of a kip and had a bite to eat. Then I came back at night and I was a stagehand. And that era, I mean, the people I saw and actually met, they would actually speak to me sometimes. You know, some big stars and Americans like Al Martino, who was the first number one in Britain. Here in My Heart was a song. And he's just been over last year at the Shaw Theatre. I didn't manage to get to see him. Not that he'd remembered meeting me. But it was a magic time. And Max Wall, I've already mentioned. And Terry Thomas. And a great comedian called Jimmy James, who was wonderful. And I was just in awe, you know, when I used to get a smack now and again because I wasn't concentrating on my work. I was watching these people. And then I was promoted or demoted. I was put up in the fly gallery right up there where you had the, you know, dropping the scenery in. The ropes are called lines, yeah. And I was up there and I learnt the job up there. Oh, and I had a heroic time one Monday morning. There was an act called the Five Smith Brothers, Geordies, and they were rehearsing on the stage, you know, the band call on a Monday morning. And I think we were playing cards up in the gallery. And the three lines, the three ropes, were tied round a sort of cleat in a particular knot, whatever it was. And I suddenly noticed that these three lines were sort of kicking off, they were loosening up. They were, and what would happen was that cloth, that bit of scenery with a wooden baton on the bottom of it, was going to go down on the heads of these five guys.
Guillotine.
So Mr. Hero jumped at these three ropes and the other lads jumped at me. And I was going up with the ropes. And the lads got hold of me and got hold of the ropes and everything. But I got an amazing rope burn on my palms. My palms are just ripped by these ropes. And I went off to Leeds General Infirmary and they dressed them. And I got fully bandaged hands. But my timing was disastrous because the following week, I can't remember how, I'd got a week's work as a comic at the aforementioned Royal Bilston, and they'd give me a week off at the Empire. It was understood that the other lads called me the Toff because I'd been at Leeds University.
For a whole year.
For a whole year. Yeah. The other lads were wonderful, the stage crew. Oh, Baz the Toff. And all the best. And I went off to Bilston with bandaged hands, mummified hands. And of course, I kept them in my pockets. And I managed, I did my rehearsal and everything. And first show on the Monday night, I did my act. And then the manager called me into his office and said, I don't want to see you working with your hands in your pockets and sloppy. And I took my hands out of my pockets and said, oh, God. I've got a comic with bandaged hands. And there was a... Oh, God, there was a singer... This is all coming out now. There was a singer called Danny Purchase, who was a... We would call him a travelling person now. The incorrect word, and Dan used to use it. He was a gypsy and proud of it. And he had a bit of success as a singer. But his brother, Bert, was in that very show. And he was a fire eater and everything. And he said, looked at my hands, he said, what's that? And I said, rope burn. And he said, trust me. And I thought, what's he talking about? So he came back to me with some sort of herbal stuff and everything. And this was an old gypsy remedy. And he said, trust me. And he went and got a dock leaf. And I was staying in some digs, you know, place in Bilston where the man who ran it said, if I'd have known you were at the theatre, I wouldn't have had you in the first place. It was a very happy week. And Bert said to me, sleep like a child with your hands together by the side of your head with a dock leaf between your hands and smear your palms with this stuff. And I thought, well, I'm desperate now, might as well. It went. It was an amazing, primitive remedy. My hands were better almost the next night. It was just an amazing Amazing time. Oh, the other thing that happened was a journalist from a local paper rang me up, from a local paper in that area, and said, oh, you're doing one of your first jobs. I said, yeah. And he said, what's your billing matter? What? I said, what does it matter? He said, no, everybody's got a catchphrase. And I said, catchphrase? He said, yeah. You got one, you're from Leeds. And I thought, this is madness. I don't know what's going on here. So I made one up. It snows the nose. It's, and this was also reported to the people doing the posters. So I arrived to find my name misspelt on the posters. It was Brian Cryan, I think. It snows the nose. And the little band... here's another story. In those days, the band would rehearse with you on a Monday morning. And nobody had told me. And I arrived on the Sunday night to meet this man who didn't want me staying at his place anyway, I later found out. And I went for a walk in Bilston, and I walked past the theatre. I thought, oh, this is interesting, this is where I'll be tomorrow. And I could hear music, and I walked in, and they were rehearsing. Nobody had told me they did it on the Sunday night. Because during the week, the lads in the band were down the pit.
Oh.
Not the orchestra pit, the miners.
Yeah, the miners, yeah.
It was just bizarre. So I wandered in, quite by accident, managed to rehearse whatever, not much, so I had to do in my act. And then, as I said, you know, Brian Cryan, it snows the nose, with bandaged hands. It was just the most bizarre week.
And wait, at that point, were you sort of like, this is my big break, this Bilston theatre?
No, I was
were
in,
you just like...
I was in a state of shock. I was an automatic pilot. I was enjoying it. I thought, I've stumbled into something I enjoy. Really, but go with the flow. You know, it just happened because of being at university at that moment. So being at university wasn't a waste of time, in a funny way, because I was in the right place at the right time. Maybe I was never meant to be academically anything. I had a half-baked idea of being a journalist. I think there was writing always in my mind. But looking back, I think, well, I owe uni something. I was in the right place. You know, you can't... You look back and you impose a pattern on your life, probably, and say, oh, that was meant to be. It just fate, where you were at any particular moment.
You know, there's some comics that are just so hungry to be on stage. They don't care if they're just standing there. And then there's other people who actually... They just enjoy whatever the whole process... I mean,
in
I don't know.
In this very pub where we're sitting now, Sabrina... Mm. Mike McIntyre, who is everywhere and hot now, he is the son of Ray Cameron, with whom I wrote all the Kenny Everett shows. And you'll get the point of this. And little Michael and his sister Susan, they were little kids, and then we all drifted apart. Dear Ray died some years ago. And I get a phone call from Mike McIntyre, who already I see is happening. Baz, where are you? Where do you live? Hatch End. What are you doing tomorrow? This was a year or so ago. I'll come over. What's your pub? I said, Moon and Sixpence. We spent 5 hours in here, this very pub, with Mike. And it was just wonderful that, you know, it was Ray Cameron's son. And it's all linking
circle,
up in a spooky way.
Yeah.
And we become mates now, and we meet up in Edinburgh and everything. And it's wonderful. What was the point? What were we talking about just before?
How were you feeling when you were doing
I know
your
what the relevance
shows,
was. Sitting in this pub, Mike McIntyre looked at me and said, Baz, you're still hungry, aren't you? The word you use. And I said, well, that's quite a sort of fierce basic word. I mean, yeah, I enjoy it. My darling wife, Terry, looked at me quite recently and said, how old are you? She said, I've come to a reluctant conclusion, you enjoy it. And I do.
After all these years. Yeah.
I do. Yeah. And I'm very conscious, having friends who've been laid off work or retired at my age and everything, that I'm still doing it. And being asked to do it, you know, I'm still on tour, I'm still doing gigs, and I just think
but
it's
for someone
marvellous.
To go to a place where they weren't wanted, with burnt hands, not knowing what they were doing.
It's not a good scenario.
There's
is
a
it?
Sort of feeling that there must have been something that you wanted to do it, because other people.
Yeah, but what could I do? I was in a situation.
You could have not done it. You could have just gone home.
Not,
and
done what? No, well, I mean, I was young and I got a job. I thought, oh my God, and I'll be sued and never work again. I don't know what I thought. I thought, I'm in this situation, just get on with it. But, you know, it was quite a bizarre week. And, of course, it was all part of the learning curve. You know, it was your early days and you were learning the business. Oh, the band leader of the minor stroke musicians, they were fascinated by this. It's nose, I know. And they said, what's that all about? And I told them, I said, it's nonsense, it's rubbish. They just asked me if I got a catchphrase. The band thought this was hilarious. So, of course, I had a very hard week, you know, dying. They weren't laughing a lot. But whenever I was really low on any of the nights, I would suddenly say, it's nose, I know, for no reason, and the band would laugh. And through the years, working with a lot of bands, a lot of musicians, you get the band on your side and they are wonderful. You give them any shit and they'll have you. They will kill you.
Warfare, but, yeah.
Yeah. But bands are such friends. But the other thing through the years was, if you're rehearsing with a band and you say something and the band laugh, take it out of the act, because they've got a different sense of you. And I've talked to a lot of musicians about this. I'm now a member, I'm thrilled, of a thing called the Coda Club, which is veteran musicians. Many, if you can believe it, older than me. Jazzers and big band musicians. And I love talking to jazzers, because they're not like fellow, if I can call myself a comic. I don't call myself a comedian, you know.
No, you call yourself a poet.
Entertainer. No,
oh, entertainer. Okay.
Comedians are different, men or women. They're different. But I love talking to jazz musicians, or musicians generally, because they generally don't tell jokes. They tell stories. You sit around a table with them, and one of them says, do you remember when we were in Bradford in 19... And they tell these most bizarre, wonderful stories about who they met and what happened. They're not jokes. They may have been embellished and not 100% true anymore, but they're great stories.
They're good
so
stories.
I love musicians' humour. And I think, I keep being called friend of the family. It's a joy in my life. A musician called me friend of the family. Kenny Everett called me Honorary Gay. The rabbi in Pinner called me Honorary Jew.
Fit in with anyone.
I think I'm Honorary everything. It's lovely. until somebody says Honorary Tory, and then I'll walk out.
Then you'll have a temper.
No, I don't want
that. Can't handle that.
Don't want that.
So you went back to Leeds and you carried on stage managing for a bit after your extraordinary week.
Yes, and then David Nixon, the magician. Did we talk about this before? He was a big star at the time.
Yeah.
And he drove up to Leeds with his wife, Joy, but in separate cars. You know, because they had a load of stuff and a load of gear. They drove in separate cars. And it was pre-M1. They drove up the A1. And she had a heart attack at the wheel and crashed and died. And David drove past the crash, not recognising it. And he arrived in Leeds, and they told him what had happened, and he collapsed and got a doctor and brandy and everything, and it was awful. And, are you going to do the pantomime? Oh, yeah. So I've got to do the pantomime for her. And somebody came up to replace her. And Leo Lyon, the manager, I'm not making these names up, with a cravat and a moustache. I intrigued him. He didn't know what this guy was. He'd been at Leeds University. He was working as a stagehand. I was called to his office. And Barry, you are going to look after Mr. Nixon.
Thank you.
So, as a sort of dresser assistant, not on the stage, you know. And I met this man who became a another mentor, lovely guy, and we became real friends. And I used to guard his dressing room door, you know, between the shows, because he would have a nap and, you know, and sleep, and was still under the trauma of losing his wife. Oh, and one day, Bernard Delfont, later Lord Delfont, the Eminence, oh my God, the Godfather,
promoter, producer,
he turned up at the stage door. He was doing a tour of pantomimes or something, and he walked down this little corridor towards me. I knew who that was, and he said, "Is Mr. Nixon in?" And I said, "Yes, but I'm terribly sorry, he's resting." And I thought, "Oh boy, what have I done?" And he looked at me, to his eternal credit, and said, "Good boy," and walked away. I've never forgotten that. And I met him later on. I didn't remind him about that. But I thought, for a big, you know, powerful sort of man in the business, and he knew the background of what had happened with David's wife and everything, I thought that was great. There's a little squid sent us out of the dressing room door saying he's resting.
No.
That was really good. Respect. I like that from
you're
a big man.
Job, yeah.
Good boy.
Yeah.
Walked away. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
So then what happened?
Oh, well, David Nixon said, "You've got to go to London," because we used to talk about this, that and the other. I told him about my false start and everything. "You've got to go to London," he said. I said, "Well, yeah." And I took him at his word. He gave me his phone number. I got an overnight train from Leeds. There used to be two rail stations in Leeds in those days. This is real old man stuff. Leeds Central, I remember that. And I sat all the way down to London overnight. I'd got a bedsit in North Finchley. And David Nixon's phone number. You look back and you think, what you do when you're young? Yeah, I had a 17-day rail return ticket. I was going to conquer London in 17 days.
Of course.
Nope. David Nixon was wonderful. I rang him, he had me at his shows, he introduced me to people, he took me out to dinner, he was wonderful to me. And on the day before the rail return ticket ran out, I got an audition at the Windmill. You couldn't make this up, and it's true. 10:30 in the morning, they did mass auditions, in, out, conveyor belt. First show was about 12:15, you know, noon. Wheel 'em on, wheel 'em off, and I went on and told some jokes and sang a song.
And these were still other people's jokes.
I suppose they were, to be honest, looking back. And I sang a little song. Ronnie Bridges, I remember his name, the pianist. And this voice from the darkness in this little theatre said, "No any more jokes. It's Vivian Van Damme, the boss." And I said, well, yes, and told a couple more. "No another song." And I said, "Well, yeah, but I haven't brought any music for it." "It's all right, Ronnie will busk it." And Ronnie Bridges, who became a friend, followed me, and I sang another song. And it was quite weird. And I just stood there. And it wasn't "We Let You Know" or anything. A man called John Law came on the stage. "Come on, come on." I said, "What?" He said, "Dressing room 12A. I said, "What? What is happening?" He said, "You've got the job, the old man's told me." Now, in the unlikely event of me doing anything that afternoon, I'd have had to cancel it. I was on the stage at 12:30.
From 10:30.
In a state of shock. Doing, somebody, in those days we wore makeup. Oh my God. Quite old days. Somebody goes and pancake that slapped on my face. My own clothes. And I went on at 12:30.
And describe what that was like, that first gig.
Well, I mean,
was it
no, I can't. I can't remember it too well because I was in a state of shock. I was just going through the motions, and I was summoned to the boss's office between every show that day.
Yes.
5 times through the 6 shows. Barry Cryer to Mr. Van Damme's office. And I stood between the fish tank and desk. "Do it." He made me do my act. And he said, "I don't like that joke. That joke's good. You should do it later. Here's a better one." He changed my act in one day. And I had to learn. What did the old man tell me? Amazing experience. And I was there for 7 months. How many 100 shows that is? It was 36 shows a week.
And after that first day, was your set virtually the same?
No, I was always tinkering with it. And I went off and lashed out and got myself a suit. Something to look. I think it was mohair. Oh, boy. I got myself a suit and some... Oh, two-tone shoes, you know. Oh, my God. What we used to call correspondent shoes for some reason. Oh, I thought that was really it. Burton's, the tailors, I remember.
And then you go back to Finchley every night.
Oh, yeah, every night. And my landlady said it's like living on top of a volcano. This, I thought, what? You know, as if I was some sort of hellraiser, this comic who came home late at night. And we used to finish, it was going on midnight by the time we finished. So I'd run down Lyle Street to Leicester Square Station, up to Finchley, then I had to get a bus to North Finchley, and then, you know, home. I used to run down Lyle Street, and of course in those days, ladies were in every doorway. And in the early days, the first week.
By ladies, can I'm just running down you mean ladies who work at night, yes.
It was hello, darling, from nearly every doorway. And I'd scurry past, had the inclination, but not my money, obviously, with my little bag. And it was wonderful and very warm. After about 2 weeks, it was, good night, duck. He's going to stay. Do you have an interval?
Yeah, that's another coat would be grand. Another. Stop this thing.
What do you want to drink?